You're listening to Spellbound.
Welcome to episode 22 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. Spellbound is now a CastBox original. You can still listen to Spellbound anywhere else you typically listen to podcasts, but check out CastBox today and see what's making it the fastest growing and highest rated podcast app for both iOS and Android. I'm joined today by Dan Harris, correspondent for ABC News, anchor for Nightline, co-anchor for the weekend edition of Good Morning America, and author of New York Times bestseller 10% Happier, subtitled How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Really Works, A True Story, which is also a mouthful, and is also now a podcast as well, as I understand. Is that right?
It is, and an app.
And an app. You're a busy guy.
Busier than I want to be.
What does the app do?
It teaches you how to meditate.
Okay, that's interesting. So what is it, like a tutorial for beginners or something, or a voice walks you through it?
Actually, it's pretty rich. We have video and audio. So we do a lot of our user. There are two ways you can use it. One is you just use, you know, you have the audio pumped into your head. The other is you watch like a quick little video clip and then of instruction, usually me talking to an amazing teacher. And then it rolls right into a guided audio meditation.
I like to think it's your voice doing the guided meditation.
I do a few, but mostly, really, I consider myself a gateway drug. So I can help people get in the door, but I'm not a really qualified teacher. I've sort of curated a group of people who have been practicing intensively for decades, and they do the most of the teaching.
Would you mind sharing your story on how you came to write this book, 10% Happier? It's just such a crazy story. I want people to hear it.
So the way it often gets told is that I had a panic attack on national television. This was back in 2004. I was anchoring the news updates on Good Morning America. And that's the guy who comes on at the top of each hour and reads a few headlines. That position has now gone away, interestingly. But
strange.
Back then, it was a pretty big deal, and I was filling in, and I'd filled in many times before, so I wasn't particularly nervous or anything that morning. But I just a couple seconds into doing my thing of reading, you know, six stories off of the teleprompter, I just couldn't breathe. I was really freaking out, and I had to quit right in the middle, and very embarrassing.
Do you remember what was going through your head in that moment? Was it like, I've never had a proper panic attack.
Panic is anxiety on steroids. So it's basically concern, but concern amped up to the point where you've really fully activated the evolutionary fight or flight response. So you're just buckets of adrenaline released into your brain. Your heart is racing. Your mind is racing. You're looking for, you know, to get out of wherever you are. It's the same physiological response you might have after after having been confronted by a saber-toothed tiger back in the days, except for it's, you know, a completely inappropriate timing. Your mind is racing, your heart is racing, your lungs seize up, your palms are sweating. In this case, I remember starting to realize that I was freaking out, that my body was, that there was some physiological thing going on, and then really worrying about not being able to keep going. And that made the bodily response worse, which then made my mind freak out worse, and over and over and over. It was like a vicious cycle. And
I'm going to send you into another panic attack just from making you talk about this.
I've talked about it so many times and watched it so many times. It's lost like any emotional charge for me.
I love that.
They do this a lot with people with PTSD. They try to make them live through the moment that is traumatizing them, because it's definitely true that if you think about it enough, if you really relive it enough, it'll lose its emotional charge. It's really kind of a magical thing.
Yeah, you face your fears, they go away.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is when you're describing it, it actually sounds way worse than it actually looks when you watch it. I'm sure it was way worse for you personally to be experiencing that anxiety in that moment than it was embarrassing for anybody else to be witnessing it, because it wasn't actually like that dramatic, you know. Like if I had just been watching casually, I probably wouldn't have even known anything was happening. But in your mind, you were a mess.
Yes. And, you know, I often say that I get one of two responses to the clip, which you can see on YouTube. You can Google or put it into the YouTube search, Panic Attack on National Television, and it's the first thing that will come up. It's great for me. Anybody who's ever had a panic attack, when they see it, they know exactly what they're looking at, and the video is really horrifying to them.
Right.
If you have not had a panic attack, you will often say, oh, well, you know, it didn't really look that bad. And I think part of that is you don't really have the visceral experience. And another part of it is that, look, I have a really good poker face. And
yeah, you're a pro.
You can tell I'm struggling. But, you know, at that point, I had had, you know, more than a decade of experience in front of the camera. And
right.
So I was able to hold it together. And the other important thing to know is that I was able to toss it back to the main anchors of the show, Diane Sawyer and Charlie Gibson. Had I not had that capability, had I, you know, if I was forced to have keep going, I then it really, really would have gotten, I would have probably run away.
Yeah. And I didn't mean to suggest that it wasn't bad or that it wasn't traumatic for you personally. I just mean that watching it, like you just said, having never had a panic attack, I don't really have a slot for it. And also you held it together so well that, you know, it's just anybody else probably would have made a much bigger fuss about it. But because you were used to being on camera and because you could throw to somebody else, it, you know, you could say you got lucky, or, you know, like,
oh, yeah.
And it could have been. In a lot of ways, you probably could have even just not even said I had a panic attack, and a lot of people probably wouldn't have even noticed.
Well, that's what I did at the time.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't admit it to anybody at the time.
You made all this up, didn't you? Just so you could write a book.
It would have been, I would have had to really do something with that video, manipulate it in some way. Yeah, maybe that was just me with a fur ball. I, at the time, everybody in the studio freaked out and was like, what's wrong with you? Are you okay? Because I, you know, I quit right in the middle of the newscast. It was supposed to be a couple minutes long, and 30 seconds in, I was like, peace. And I lied. I said that nothing had happened. And because of just what you're describing, that, you know, visually, it could have been anything. They, you know, I got away with it.
What led up to that moment for you? It was a long journey. Why don't you just give us the cliff notes?
Yeah, I often say that as embarrassing as having a panic attack is, the backstory is even more embarrassing. I had been in TV news for a long time. I started in local news right out of college in the early 90s. And then in the year 2000, when I was only 28, I got a job at ABC News. And it was this incredible opportunity, but kind of super terrifying. And out of ambition and idealism and curiosity, I, after 9/11, I volunteered to go overseas. And I spent a lot of time in war zones, Iraq, Afghanistan, blah, blah, blah. And it kind of messed me up. I got depressed. And in order to deal with my depression, I did an incredibly smart thing, which is I started using a ton of cocaine.
Always and a good idea.
Yes, definitely. Every doctor will recommend that. And so I wasn't doing it that much. You know, it's not like I was high every day. I wasn't high the morning I had the panic attack. And I never used it when I was working or on the air or anything like that. But I was partying a lot, let's just say, in my spare time. And after I had the panic attack, I went to a doctor, and the doctor asked me a bunch of questions. And one of the questions was, do you do drugs? And I said, yes. And he, as I like to joke, gave me a look that communicated, okay, asshole, mystery solved. He just pointed out that even though I had been doing it intermittently, it was enough to artificially raise the level of adrenaline in my brain and make it more likely for somebody. I already had a sort of a baseline level of anxiety and stage fright anyway, ironically, given my career. And it just amped that up.
I mean, you saw a lot of things overseas when in war zones that a lot of people don't have to see. You saw, you know, probably a very raw version of what people see, even on the news. When people see these clips of things that are happening over there, I'm sure it was way worse just being there. And not only because you're seeing it in person, but you're seeing the stuff that they can't put on TV. So, you know, it makes sense that, you know, you come back, you're going to need to deal with that somehow. And, you know, there's a million ways to do that. And, you know, you were partying to kind of try to like ease your mind. And then you eventually found meditation.
That's right. You know, the interesting thing is, by the way, that I wasn't traumatized by what I had seen overseas. It wasn't like, no, I definitely saw a lot of gnarly things, but the problem for me was that I liked it too much. And that's
interesting.
I want to be clear. It's not like I'm a ghoul. I don't like violence. But I got addicted to the adrenaline rush of being on TV, and not just being on TV. I'm sorry, but being in a war zone. So being in a war zone and being on TV is a super intoxicating, thing for a young guy. I was pretty young at the time. And it was, you know, imagine you're like just turned 30 and you're, you know, in Afghanistan right after 9/11, or you're, you know, leading ABC News's coverage in Baghdad. And it was really heady stuff. And I would come home and, you know, just have to put my pants on in the morning. And, you know, I guess I still had an exciting job, but I wasn't in a war zone. That's what got me depressed. I was kind of addicted to the adrenaline, and cocaine was a synthetic squirt of adrenaline, and that really messed me up. But yeah, so to get to your actual question, just to be clear, after I had that fateful conversation with the shrink who pointed out that the cocaine had led to the panic attack, I didn't like start meditating in that moment. it wasn't on my radar at all. I mean, I was always, you know, I thought meditation was bullshit. I hadn't spent much time thinking about meditation, but to the extent that I had, it struck me as hippie nonsense, and I would not have reacted well if somebody had said, hey, you should start meditating. And so it took many years. That panic attack kind of set me off on a little odyssey that ultimately led me to meditation probably a couple of years later, like I would say maybe 2008 or 9. And what really got me interested was the science. It can lower your blood pressure and boost your immune system. And the neuroscience is amazing. It suggests that basically you're rewiring your brain when you meditate. I'm not a scientist. My parents are both scientists. My wife is a scientist. I'm not really good at math, but I respect science. And that spoke to me, and one of the areas where the research is the strongest is in anxiety and depression, that meditation can have a salutary effect there. And I've dealt with both of those, my whole life. So that was very compelling to me. And that is what ultimately started me on meditation.
So what was that journey like? Were you, how did you go from doing cocaine to just quitting all that stuff you were doing, and then you're meditating in your house? How does that shift happen?
So it's kind of multifactorial. I first thing I did was I quit doing drugs, and I agreed to go see this shrink often, you know, once or twice a week for a long time, because quitting drugs is not really easy. And it was actually, he was the one who ultimately recommended it. But the other thing that happened in the interim was that I had been assigned to cover faith and spirituality for ABC News. And in the process of that, I came across a book by Eckhart Tolle, who's a self-help guru.
Oh, yeah.
So at first I thought the book was just totally crazy. And in many ways, it is a little weird.
Yeah, he's a weirdo.
But he's a strange guy. But Eckhart Tolle was the first person I ever heard describe what he calls the voice in the head, which he's not referring to schizophrenia or hearing voices or something. He's talking about your inner narrator, as I like to describe, you know, the voice that chases you out of bed in the morning and is yammering at you all day long. You're like constantly wanting or not wanting, judging people, judging yourself, thinking about the past, thinking about the future, to the detriment of whatever's happening right now. And Tolle describes this phenomenon, the human ego, the human inner narrator, really well, really beautifully, nestled in amongst some other kind of stranger stuff. And that was incredibly interesting to me, because it's just intuitively true, but although nobody had ever pointed it out to me before. And once I started thinking about the voice in the head, I realized, like, that's why I had the panic attack, because my ego you know, the voice in my head said, hey, you know, you should go to the war zones without thinking about the consequences. And then I came home and wasn't self-aware enough to know I was depressed. And then I, you know, kind of blindly self-medicated. And so that was a pretty powerful reading experience for me to be kind of taking all that in. And I ended up, you know, going off and meeting Eckhart Tolle, and I found it to be very frustrating because he didn't have any actionable advice for dealing with the voice in the head. And I then spent a bunch of time nosing around the self-help industry, which is just a howling sea of bullshit. And it was ultimately a combination of my shrink and a book that my wife gave me by another shrink who's a Buddhist that turned me on to meditation. At first, I really rejected it, but once I saw the science, I got on the horse.
And what kind of science is there? What kind of evidence that it actually helps?
It's important to say that the science is really in its early stages and sometimes overly hyped. And some of the science, frankly, isn't that good. But when you look at it in totality, I think the way I like to phrase it is that it strongly suggests, the existing science strongly suggests that meditation, even a short daily doses of it, can confer a long list of health benefits. You know, like I said before, it can lower your blood pressure. It can also reduce the release of stress hormones. It's very good for anxiety and depression, apparently. And then the neuroscience shows that when you meditate, you're kind of like performing neurosurgery on yourself. You're changing key areas of the brain that have to do with focus, which is a diminished resource in this era.
Absolutely.
But the attention regulation, that part of the brain can get, you know, fluffed up through this daily exercise of meditation. Self-awareness, compassion, the area of this associated with stress. And at least one study was shown to shrink. So it's really interesting stuff.
How long are you meditating now? Like, are you doing it daily, and for how long?
I started with 5 to 10 minutes a day. And I really...
You're about to blow us out of the water with what you're doing now.
Well, what I fear is I'm about to annoy and alienate you with what I say. So I started with 5 to 10 minutes a day. And the reason why I'm evading your question just momentarily is because I think it's important to point out that I think 5 to 10 minutes a day is a great meditation habit. And while the scientists have not sort of fully nailed the dosage question, like everybody wants to know what's the least amount I can do and get the benefits. And we don't know, but generally speaking, in my...
That sounds like the wrong approach.
Yeah, but that's human nature. And, you know, as somebody who, you know, my job is to get people to consider this kind of self-care, and you got to work with what you got. And so I don't expect everybody to, you know, the people who are like looking for spiritual enlightenment, they're already meditating. I'm talking to skeptics, and I want to make sure that my message is geared toward the folks who are likely to reject this thing, but would get a lot out of it. So I take that very seriously. So I'm always kind of thinking, how would the pre-meditation me react to anything I'm about to say?
Yeah, that's smart. And that's smart.
So 5 to 10 minutes a day, I really believe is enough. And honestly, if you only do 1 minute most days, I think that counts. So having said that, I'm 9 years in, I guess. I do 2 hours a day.
2 hours of meditation every day.
Yes, but the follow-up to that will make it less impressive. So it's not like I do it in one fell swoop. I had it in my head a couple of years ago that 2 hours a day was what serious meditators do. I don't know where I got that from. Maybe one of the early books I read by the guy who ultimately became my teacher personally, Joseph Goldstein. In one of his early books, he had recommended that practitioners meditate for an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening. And so I had him, and also a neuroscientist buddy of mine who I really respect was doing 2 hours a day. He was doing it one go early in the morning. So I just had it in my head that this is like what the heavy hitters do. And I wanted to be a heavy hitter, if that even exists in the meditation context. And so a friend of mine who's quite a prominent meditation teacher herself, Sharon Salzberg, she said that she knew somebody who had the same idea, and that the way he got himself to do it was that he told himself he could do as many sessions as he wanted, wherever he wanted, whenever he wanted throughout the day. And it just had to add up to 2 hours. So that's what I do. So for about 3 years now, I've just endeavored during the course of the day to get in enough meditation. But like, I'll do it in the backseat of a Uber. I'll do it on a plane. I'll do it in my bedroom or in my apartment when the, you know, kid's not tantruming. I do it in my office. I just airports, wherever I can, I just aim. And sometimes the sessions will be just a couple minutes long, and sometimes they'll be, you know, an hour and a half. It's really what's available to me.
You listen to your own voice in the guided meditation app?
No, I definitely do not do that.
That could backfire.
Yeah, that strikes me as a mistake. Yeah. I mostly I do it on my own, but I also do use the app because there are so many amazing teachers in there, and you know, we have all these different kinds of meditation. So I do use the app as well.
So how do you keep track of if you're doing 2 hours every day? You have like a stopwatch that you keep on you or something, or is it just approximate 2 hours? Or
in the app we have a timer. So
oh, that's cool.
I'll set a timer. And you can link it up to Mindful Minutes in Apple has a thing called Mindful Minutes. And so you can link it right up to that. But even if you don't want to go that far, you just, I found that even on, you know, as soon as day two or three, it seamlessly started carrying a mental tally. If you stop me at any point at any day and ask me, how much meditation have you done today? I can answer immediately. I always know how much I've done. I don't know why. I just do. And so I use the timer on my phone, on the app, or I'll use the stopwatch feature in the iWatch. And I just keep a running tally as I go.
You've felt the difference that meditation's made in your life. Have you had any people who know you really well notice a difference in your personality or your energy?
So I tell a story that people often take as a joke, but it's actually a true story, that one of the earliest signs to me, just a few weeks after I started meditating, that it was working, was that I would overhear my wife at cocktail parties telling my friends that I was less of a shithead. And that is actually true. And that was actually a really compelling data point. And I would argue, even as jokey as it sounds, that's a really important thing to know. And people ask me a lot, well, Dan, how do I know if my meditation is working? And my answer is always, are you less of an asshole? And there's a slight asterisk to that, because it's, are you less of an asshole to yourself and others? You know, so what's your inner weather like? Is it balmier? Is it calmer? Are you beating yourself up less? And are you therefore acting out less? And that's it's a pretty rough measurement, but it's a good way to think about what meditation does, especially at the beginning stages. But to get more specific, I mean, there are two very specific inner attributes that I noticed increasing after starting meditation. One is that it boosted my ability to focus, which I had never been really good at. But, you know, what meditation is trying to focus on one thing at a time, usually the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. Let me be more specific there. Mindfulness meditation, because there are millions of kinds of meditation. But when I talk about meditation, I'm talking about mindfulness meditation, which is derived from Buddhism. What mindfulness meditation is, generally for beginners, is you try to feel the raw data of the physical sensations of your breath coming in and going out. And then every time you get distracted, you start again. And you will get distracted a million times. That a lot of people think that's a failure when you get distracted. But in fact, getting distracted and starting again is meditation. It is a victory. Why is it a victory? Because when you see how distractible you are, when you see how crazy you are, the craziness owns you less. And that is really what you're building over time. So it's these dual skills of focus/concentration, you know, the ability to return to the task, in this case, your breath. And the second is a kind of self-awareness known as mindfulness, which is the ability, you know, every time you see how crazy you are and you're able to kind of see it for what it is and let it go and go back to your breath, over time, you develop this ability to see your mental activity without being yanked around by it. And that's really the change agent here, because, you know, most of the thing, if not everything we do that we regret the most, is when we get carried away by the malevolent puppeteer of our ego. You know, we eat when we're not hungry. We say, you know, the thing that's going to ruin the next 48 hours of our marriage. We, you know, check our email in the middle of a conversation. All of those things are because the voice in our head is just completely yanking us around. And meditation helps you see what the voice in your head is doing and saying, so that in a way that you don't take it as the gospel truth. And those two attributes for me, focus and mindfulness, were really useful. And basically they're skills that you can just keep generating. You start to notice you're getting a little bit better at the beginning of meditation, which at the beginning it's awkward and weird and hard. And it stays awkward and weird and hard, by the way. But it gets less so. You get better at it. You get more fluid at it. And the skills, as they show up in your actual life, of being able to stay on task, being able to listen to people, being less carried away by your own anger or sadness or whatever it is, all that just gets better and better and better. So I like to semi-facetiously say that the 10% happier compounds annually. And because the laws of physics aren't, you know, it's not like you're training your body here, you're training your mind, that the laws of physics don't apply in the same way, I feel like there's much less of a ceiling.
A lot of people really get discouraged when they first start meditating. I'm sure it's always been hard. I mean, people have been meditating since, you know, it's an ancient practice, obviously, but it seems like a really difficult time with the, like you said, the attention span shrinking and people getting instant gratification every waking moment with these devices they carry around. And, you know, I think it's just so, it seems like a really good practice to get in the habit of just focusing on, your internal, climate, like you said earlier. I love that picture, the internal weather. It's because that's totally how you feel inside is how you're going to project onto others and how you're going to manifest your reality.
How you feel inside is literally everything. It's your whole life.
Right.
Everything in the external world, quote unquote, is refracted through the prism of your mind. So it's all you got. I'm always saying this to people that we spend a lot of time working on our stock portfolios, our bodies, our cars, our YouTube feed, whatever, and almost no time, most of us, working on the one filter through which we experience everything, and that's our mind. And all the things we really want the most. I mean, if you think about it, if you start a probing conversation with anybody about what they really want, they may start at the level of things or achievements. You know, I want a job promotion. I want to get married. I want to have a Lamborghini, whatever. But if you keep pressing down to what they really want, it's always just positive mental states. Mm-hmm. They want happiness. They want connection. They want, and as it turns out, these states are not factory settings that can't be tinkered with. What the science, especially the neuroscience, is showing us is that happiness, generosity, compassion, these are skills that you can generate just the way you can work on your body in the gym. And that is an incredibly empowering and radical notion. And that's my message in a nutshell, that happiness is a skill. And yes, it is very common, to get back to your question, very common for beginners to feel like this sucks, I can't do this, because they're noticing that they're becoming distracted a lot. And especially for type A people who, you know, myself included, where you expect to do a thing and get a specific result, what meditation is asking you to do is to go in expecting to quote unquote fail. But that quote unquote failure needs to be reframed as a victory. Because when you wake up from distraction, even on the millionth time, that is a win. That is truly a win. Because when, as I said before, when you see how fucking crazy you are, the craziness owns you less. And you're waking up to this fundamental fact of life, which is that you have a voice in the head and that there is this nonstop conversation you are having with yourself. Most of it negative, repetitive, self-referential, and it owns you when you don't see it. Nobody is immune to this. And you will, you are actually seeing what your life is about when you sit down, close your eyes, and try to focus on one thing, and then allow the distraction pageant to begin. I've found in talking to people about meditation practice that telling them that quote unquote failing is succeeding, reframing it in that way, can just sort of open up the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a total discipline, and anything worth doing in life requires that.
Very few other skills do people try once and say, I can't do this. You know, if you were endeavoring to learn how to play the flute, you wouldn't expect on the first time to, you know, be able to bang out a Jethro Tull solo. But
right.
If people sit and try to meditate, and they automatically conclude, I can never do this.
Well, it's misleading because it seems so simple. It's like, it seems simpler than playing the flute, because it's like, oh, all I have to do is sit here and think about nothing. This should be so simple. And then you try to do it and you're like, damn, I suck at this. You get so discouraged. But like you're saying, that's just part of the journey, and that part never stops. And the challenges change, you grow, you get better, but the challenge is always there.
I would think about it like going to the gym. If you go to the gym and it's ever easy, you're cheating. I mean, you're supposed to be panting and sweating no matter how much practice you have. And that's the point. That is the exercise. And the same thing is true with meditation. You are supposed to see your crazy emotions and desires and random thinking. The goal is to create a sort of a full frontal collision there with all of your madness, so that it doesn't yank you around. And I just think that's what needs to be said from the beginning.
So you've gotten off cocaine. Do you use any like do you do cannabis? Do you drink a beer every now and then? Do you do anything like that?
Yeah, I'm like the most annoyingly straight edge person you could meet. It's actually not for any one reason, and definitely not because I'm a teetotaler, you know, or like a teetotaler by nature. I am a teetotaler, not really by choice, but I quit doing drugs because it really messed me up. So that's not on the table.
What about caffeine?
I don't do caffeine because it's really bad for people with panic disorder.
Wow, you're really clean, man. Good for you.
Well, but so I love caffeine. It really does not agree with me, so I really have no choice. If it made me feel good, I probably would use it in some way. But like, it actually really, I have some sort of allergic reaction to it. It just makes me feel awful. Even chocolate, frankly, makes me feel awful.
I feel like you're about to tell me you eat bacon every day or something.
No, the list is, it's going to get worse. I also don't drink. Because I developed like an odd allergic reaction to it. I just feel sick after like a sip of, this happened to me in like 8 or 9 years ago. I just had to stop because it was making me feel like shit. Once a year I'll be at a wedding and I'll have a couple drinks or even a drink, but I will pay for it for a full day afterwards. And it's really not fun. I don't have sugar because I am an addict and I really love sugar. And if I have one cookie, I will have 75 cookies. And I struggled with this for years, and I would allow myself like a treat day once a week, but inevitably it would lead to me feeling sick for an entire day. And so I realized that this is an addiction, and I just quit back in September, and I plan on never, ever having sugar again, just because A, it's incredibly unhealthy, but B, because I can't handle it. My wife can have it in moderation, but I'm a pig, you know? And so it was like, it would lead to embarrassing levels of consumption. I don't eat meat. That's very recent. About 3 months ago, I really succumbed to the intellectual and emotional entreaties of a lot of my friends in the meditation world who feel very strongly about animal cruelty. Intellectually, I had embraced the argument for years, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And then one day I was eating some chicken and I was like, this is gross. And I kind of never looked back. That I could see the whole veganism thing. I feel like I'm going to stick with it, but I could see that, you know, that's the one that's the newest and the weakest. What else?
I appreciate the honesty.
I never really liked weed that much. And I am very interested in psychedelics. because there's all this new all this talk and all this research that suggests that it's, you know, could produce a spiritual awakening and all whatever that means. But my shrink and my wife, both of them doctors, feel that for somebody with panic disorder who still has to go on television, messing with my brain chemistry is unwise. So that's the psilocybin's going to have to wait until I retire from TV. But look, I just want to be clear. I am a super straight edge, and it's really annoying. But
I find it refreshing. I don't think it's annoying at all. I'm actually very impressed to hear all that.
Well, it's annoying to some people because, you know, when I describe it to people, there is this like sense that even if I'm not saying it, that somehow I'm being judgy about it. And I get it. I used to hate vegans. I still hate many of them.
Well, you haven't even sworn loyalty to veganism yet, so I'm not holding that one against you. I used to be vegan too.
Oh, really? I want to write a book called How to Go Vegan Without Being a Douchebag.
Yeah, that's a good book.
A way to do it without being annoying. Like, I definitely believe that it's cruel to kill animals and eat them. Like, I don't like that. Let me just say, for example, I'm kind of friendly with this guy, Joe Rogan. I've been on his podcast a couple times. He's a hunter, and he'll go out and kill an elk or whatever and eat it. I don't really have a problem with. It's the factory farming aspect.
I'm with you on that 100%. The factory farming thing is really messed up.
Yeah, it's really messed up. Having said that, like, I care about global warming too, and I'm not watching my carbon footprint. Look, there are any number of major issues out there, and not every one of us cannot be on the side of the angels at every single one of these. So, like, I don't. Go screaming. My wife eats meat, and I'm not like screaming at her, you know, meat is murder every time she has a chicken nugget with our 3-year-old. That to me is douchebaggery right there. I don't feel like preaching is going to get anybody anywhere. I'm just happy to do the thing. And if somebody wants to talk about it, I'll talk about it. And maybe over time it contributes to some sort of behavior change on their part, or maybe it doesn't. But I kind of have a similar attitude around meditation. Like, I don't talk to anybody about it unless they ask me about it. And if they do, I won't like lecture them about it.
Right. Yeah. And I pulled all that dietary stuff out of you anyways. I didn't feel like it was preachy. I think, there's definitely, I find myself in a lot of conversations with people who are on these dieting fads and they want me to like join their cult. And, I've tried a number of them. I actually feel great on some of them.
Yeah. You know, for me, what I've really noticed is that this is a bit of an overused term, but the whole thing around mind body connection. When I eat like shit, like I really feel like shit, and it my meditation practice is just basically super foggy and unpleasant. And I'm willing to pay the social price and the whatever price of inconvenience around not having whatever I want whenever I want it in order to have a clearer mind that seems like it's more aligned with my values, to get a little schmoopy there. To me, that just seems like it's worth it.
Anything else you want to say about meditation or any plugs for your app or anything like that you want to say before we wind this down?
No, I feel like I've done plenty of plugging. The only thing I'd say about meditation is really just to remind people that all the things you want, like the mental states you want, are trainable attributes, and you know that's really cool. And it just requires that you do the things to train your mind. There are lots of ways to train your mind, but I think meditation is a pretty obvious one.
Well, Dan, thanks for making the time. Great talking to you, and I wish you the best with everything you're doing.
We're going to turn it over to the listeners. We want to know what you think about meditation. Have you meditated before? Have you tried to do it? Just got frustrated, like Dan was saying, happens to so many people. I, for one, could probably make a lot more time in my schedule for meditation. I've personally felt its benefits, and for some reason, I just always fall off the wagon. But Dan's app, 10% Happier, seems like a great solution. If you're trying to keep track of your daily meditation, leave a comment with your thoughts. That's what this whole podcast is about. This is a conversation, not a monologue. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. That way your phone will always stay up to date. Next week, we're talking to Andrew Rader and Ramona Pringle about your personal data, the hottest commodity on the planet right now. Algorithms, how they put your information at risk, and a bunch of other interesting things that are just worth knowing about. Don't miss that next week, next Monday. Hope you guys have a great rest of your week, and I will see you soon.